So the next session, we're going to talk about the PDB again. So a little bit on the protein data bank and molecular visualization. And probably the most exciting thing for you guys will be the molecular visualization part. But I wanted to go over a little bit more in detail on how files in the PDB are generated, so that you know what to look for. And then also how to go through or how to look at a PDB file and what makes a PDB file a PDB file. Because that can be very useful if you're looking at a structure and you want to do some very simple calculations. Oftentimes when we want to do calculations on a PDB file, we write our own little computer programs to do it. But the structure of the file is simple enough that you guys can really just load into Excel, load all the atomic coordinates, and start doing calculations right there. And so, as we went over yesterday, there's two main types of experimental techniques that are used to generate atomic coordinates. The first of which is X-ray crystallography, and the second of which is NMR spectroscopy. And so, in the chemistry department here, we now have access to both of these. So we just got an X-ray system with a copper, not a copper cathode, but a copper tube for generating, I think 1.5 angstrom X-rays, which is good for proteins. We also have a molybdenum tube, which is better for small molecules, and that's what's mostly used in the department. We can actually do rough protein structures here using our X-ray system. But most of the time what you do if you're going to do an X-ray structure that's going to be published is you're going to take that to a synchrotron lab, and you can basically do the same amount of work in about an hour that you can do in several days using a standalone X-ray system here or at another type of institution that's not a synchrotron. Okay, and so, and I guess I know a little bit about this because as an undergraduate researcher, I worked in a crystallography lab and I did my time at CHESS where we had to stay up all night in the synchrotron. Anyway, but now more often than not, I spend most of my time with the NMR. And so with an NMR, basically instead of getting a nice three-dimensional electron density map of your protein, you're getting information like this atom is 20 angstroms away from this atom. And if you get enough of that type of information, you can start to put together a rough idea of what your protein structure is. But that said, most of the files, if you look at the PDB, they're going to be used using X-ray crystallography. This number is a year old now, so it's probably up closer to 130,000 total structures in the PDB. But the percentage is probably going to be about right. 85 to 90% of those are going to be crystal structures. And the remaining 10 to 15% are going to be NMR structures. And that's just because crystal structures, for a lot of purposes are better and higher resolution. When you build an X-ray structure, and again, the theory behind how this is done is way beyond a three-day session or like an hour and a half session. But essentially what you're doing is you're looking at the electrons that are essentially scattering the photons of X-ray energy that you're sending at the molecule itself. Okay, and so maybe not from your physics classes, you know that electrons interact with photons because the electric charge, obviously, of an electron interacts with the electric wave of a photon. And so because of that interaction, if a photon, an X-ray photon, hits an electron cloud, it's going to interact and scatter a little bit. And if you line up a billion of these, well, maybe not a billion, but several thousand of these molecules in an identical situation, like in a crystal, the pattern of scattering is going to be enough that you can generate a nice coherent reflection coming off of that crystal. And by looking at the pattern of reflections and doing some calculations, you can sort of back calculate the electron density that gave you the scattering pattern that you observed. Okay, so this is all about model building. You know, basically you're looking at an observable, which is your reflections, and you're back calculating the electron density that gave you that observable. That's sort of the very, very quick hand-waving argument for what's happening. But what you get out of an X-ray map is basically a grid, which is drawn here, and that grid represents the electron density that scatters and creates the reflections that you observe. And so when you start out, you're usually at relatively poor refinement, and so your electron density may or may not agree very well. But as you go through the refinement process and you get better and better, you can see that this grid, in this particular case, it looks like some kind of tryptophan, although it's not some kind of methylated or some kind of tryptophan with an extra atom. But you can see that your X-ray density or your electron density maps to the structure fairly well. And so you basically, building a crystal structure is a combination of putting your molecule into the electron density and sort of calculating and refining that model until you get the best agreement possible. Keep in mind, this is your refinement factor here. R is 31 versus R is 20%. When we talk about refinement factors, this is the same refinement factor we looked at yesterday. You can see that the refinement factor gets much better the lower it goes. And this is an iterative process. You're often using molecular mechanics, molecular dynamics to help you refine your structure to build it. And so, once an experimentalist generates that, then they have to do some calculations. And ultimately, the goal is to get your structure submitted to the PDB and, maybe a Nature publication if you can do it. Typically nowadays, and these have changed. I mean, these are different from what they were 10 years ago. What you're looking at is you have these kinds of qualifications to be a fairly good crystal structure. And so as you guys use the PDB, you should be thinking about these things in the back of your head. The R factor, again, what we just looked at, you can see the smaller R is, the better agreement is between the electron density and the data. Okay, and so if I were to show you the equation for the R factor, you would probably say, wow, that looks kind of similar to chi-squared. Okay, and so R is just a measure of how well your molecular structure, the three-dimensional positions of the atoms, agree with the calculated electron density. Okay, so think of it as a chi-squared, although it's not strictly speaking a chi-squared, but it has the same format. And so the smaller your R factor, similar to chi-squared, the better. So if you have an R squared or an R less than 25% or less than 20%, that means that there's pretty good agreement. R free is related to your R factor. It's always higher because it's calculated. Basically what you do when you generate an R free is you take some data that you observed and you throw it out and you don't use it in the refinement process. So basically you take some, 10% of your reflections, and you say, I'm not going to use these to refine my molecule. And then you do the refinement process with 90% of your data. And then you look at the agreement between that 10% that you looked at, you left out, and your final structure from the other 90%. And so essentially it's a way of making sure that you're not fooling yourself, that you're not overfitting your data, sort of like what we talked about yesterday. And so because you've thrown out data and you've not used all the possible data to generate your R-free, It's always going to be bigger than the plain old R. But ideally here again, you want it below 25%. Some structures you can get away with up to 30%, but generally you want that small too. Resolution, generally a good structure. You know, the best structures in the PDB are sub 1 angstroms, which means that you can differentiate features less than 1 angstrom apart. So I can look at, you know, this nucleus, and or this electron cloud, and this electron cloud, and I can tell if one is more intense, even if they're less than 1 angstrom away from each other. That's the definition of resolution. So, and at sub 1 angstroms, you know, given that the electron cloud of a hydrogen atom is about 1 angstrom, you start to be able to see your hydrogen atoms. Generally, in a PDB file, if you look at the PDB, there, you know, all of your hydrogen atoms are missing. And the reason for that is because there's no data to basically put where they are. I mean, you can estimate where they are, but the resolution isn't good enough to resolve hydrogen atoms, typically. And so, less than 1 angstrom, that's great resolution. Oftentimes, though, you know, 1.5 angstrom is pretty good. And usually that's plenty good enough to get you into the PDB. But even something at 2.5 angstroms, if you're just looking for the gross structural features of a protein or a DNA molecule, you know, 2.5 angstroms, even 3.5 angstroms might be perfectly fine. You know, the ribosome got published in Nature, and I think it was like 3.5 angstroms was the first, or 3.5-4 angstroms was the first structure of the ribosome to be published. And the reason it got in Nature wasn't because it was so high resolution, it was because so many people have been trying to crystallize the ribosome for so many years, and it's such an important biological molecule that, you know, that you had low angstrom resolution, it didn't matter so much. And so, you know, think about what you might need for resolution, and if you can get by with a 2.2 angstrom structure, then that's probably fine. Okay? Validation. We're going to look at a couple of websites here on the PDB to sort of go over what the validation statistics looks like, but obviously, you know, you don't want your PDB file to be solved where two atoms are in like a real big steric clash. And you know, nowadays that doesn't happen so much, but in particular back in the 80s and early 90s, when the structural validation software wasn't so good, lots of structures were in the PDB, allowed into the PDB, even though they had, you know, strange torsion angles or steric clashes between two molecules or two atoms. And so you might want to keep an eye on that, particularly if you're doing something like drug binding. You're trying to design a drug to fit into a particular protein pocket. If that protein pocket has ridiculous torsions and bad, you know, steric clash, it might not be so good. The other thing is you generally want to keep an eye on the water molecules. So here again, you think of a crystal being something that's relatively rigid. But it turns out there's actually a lot of water in a protein crystal, to the point where oftentimes if you have an enzyme and you take, you know, suppose you have a substrate that's, you know, 200-300 Daltons, so 200-300 grams per mole, some small molecule, but not like tiny. Oftentimes you can take your crystal and put it into a solution containing the enzyme substrate, and that substrate is able to diffuse into the crystal and you know, go in there. And so a crystal, you know, you think of it as being this very tightly packed thing, but protein crystals actually have a lot of solvent in them. And because of that, you occasionally will see water molecules sort of loosely attached or loosely associated with your protein. And so because of that, you know, crystallographers will often build those water molecules in, and that's a good thing. It tells you, oh, look, there's a very strong hydrogen bond between this, you know, serine in this water. On the other hand, and again, this is less common today than it was before, but you know, if you have lots of extra electron density, so electron density you can't explain, it's pretty easy to just say, oh, there's a water molecule there. And so you could easily exploit this water molecule idea by saying, oh, well, I don't really know what that extra electron density is, so I'm just going to put 4 or 5 water molecules in there that sort of fit in the electron density, and you know, that's going to be my solution. And so it's reasonable for you to have water molecules in your PDB file, but you know, if you have a 6 kilo Dalton protein and you have, you know, 4,000 water molecules, that might be a red flag. So you know, there's a rough rule of thumb, 2 to 5 water molecules per kilodalton is a good number. Some proteins you'll go in the PDB, there won't be any. Some proteins there'll be more than that, but you know, it can raise a red flag if you have a ton of them, particularly if the water molecules have hydrogens. Like, so anyway, but that gets to beside the point. Okay, the PDB Revisited. Again, you guys know this website. It was on the first page. And so, yeah, this is, a duplicate slide. But what we can do is we're going to look at a couple of examples here of how to assess this and where you can find things like R-free. So here is a newer structure, 3TJW. Okay, so this was done in 2012. Villain headpiece is a small, it's 34 residues long. It's part of a larger protein. And so it's part of a larger villain protein is the name of the thing. So the villain headpiece, though, is one of the fastest folding subdomains of all the proteins that are known to exist. And so I think it folds in a microsecond or two. And so because of that, lots of people like to study it. And because it's so small, I mean, it almost borderlines on the small molecule regime. But remember that we took a look down here at experimental details. And so because this is a newer protein, you can see that it has everything filled in, right? So we can download structure factors. So remember I talked about the other day how you can download the experimental data. So the structure factors are basically the reflections that you see when you shine an X-ray beam at this crystal. You can also go to the electron density server. And so this can be extremely useful. We have a couple of people who are from, because Kuhn does crystallography, right? Some crystallography?
We send it away.
You send it away? Okay. So then nobody in here does crystallography. I don't really do it so much anymore, but back in the day, I had to calculate electron density maps. And it turns out that the computation of taking a set of structure factors, the experimental data, and calculating the electron density is not at all straightforward. You used to have to use a program called CNS. I think there were 3 separate scripts that you had to run. I mean, it wasn't difficult. It was just a pain in the butt. And if you didn't have that particular software installed, you had to get it installed, and it was annoying. And so right about the time when I was in graduate school, this group, I think this is over in Uppsala, but they came up with this idea, is rather than making us do all this, let's just do that calculation for any structure in the PDB where they've submitted their experimental data and make the electron density maps freely available for download. And so that's great. I mean, so the electron density server has that. And so if you click on that EDS link, you can download maps. And generally you want to download, I mean, this isn't such a part of the tutorial here, but generally you want to download an FO minus FC, or 2MFO minus FC. So that means You 2 times the observed calculation, or the observed map, minus 1 times the calculated map. And so you get a contribution in there from the observed structure, you get a contribution in there from your calculated structure, and the subtraction, the difference is about 1. So you get 1 map, something. I never really understood the algebra there, but it works, and it gives you something reasonable. If you're going to be using Pymol, for Pymol, the best option here is CNS format, because it can read it directly, although Pymol might be able to read O directly now too. But the point is that you can go to this electron density server map, or this electron density server, and download the X-ray electron density map, load it into Pymol, plot it, and actually compare how well the structure from the PDB agrees with the calculated electron density from the original data. So that's kind of nice, and it's useful at some times. Okay. But let's take a look at some of these other things. So again, they have the R value of 0.152. So that's actually very good. If we use 20% as our cutoff, I mean, this is 15%. And our R-free is even less than 20%. And so, you know, looking at the refinement values, those values are very, very good. And if we think about, you know, if we look at some of the other structural validation tools, so here they give you sort of a histogram or a distribution relative to other structures in the PDB. Okay, and so you can compare the R-free, so for this value, it's 0.19, compared to some of the other ones. They have percentile relative to all X-ray structures, percentile relative to structures of similar resolution. And so, given that the best value here is 0.175, this value is actually quite good. You can see it's, you know, if this is the top 10%, this is the bottom 10%, it's actually quite high. The clash score, again, you can imagine that measures steric clash, so the better that is, the less steric clash there is. And so clash score of 5 would be perfect, or the best you can find right now. Ramachandran outliers, so remember Eileen's discussion of the Ramachandran plot, how many phi psi torsions fall outside the acceptable range of the Ramachandran plot? So there's none. Side chain outliers, so how many side chains lie outside of the normal observed conformations of side chains? None. I don't know what RSRZ outliers are, but it's probably important. The point is that if you look at this structure, everything is, you know, here in the good range. Okay, meaning that you can probably take this structure very, very seriously. And it's probably a good representation of what this chicken villain headpiece looks like. Now, you always sort of have to keep in mind that it is a crystal structure, and sometimes the crystallization process does introduce artifacts. And so two of the proteins that I've studied in my lifetime have crystal structures where there was a big, you know, essentially there was a flexible loop, and so the loop really wasn't well defined, but because you packed so many proteins together, what you could see is the loop from one protein interacted with the next crystal unit over, and you got this sort of ridiculous conformation. And so it was pretty obvious just by looking at the structure that there was no way that loop was rigid. You know, most of the time, if your loop is floppy, you know, you're not seeing it. Remember, you have to see lots and lots of X-ray photons from a fairly rigid structure to get a nice reflection. And so if you have something that's very flexible, oftentimes you don't see any electron density because it's not rigid enough to give you a good electron density. And so if you see something sort of that looks totally non-physical, some rigid loop floating off into solution somewhere, generally that's a sign that maybe there's an interaction between it and the next, you know, the next crystal unit over. So again, there's a lot of deeper science that we could talk about here with crystal structures. And if you're curious, we can, you know, you can take my graduate biophysics class. We have about a 4-week unit where we do crystals or X-ray crystallography. Whenever that's offered next. Okay, so here's another example. So I'm not going to have, I'm not going to go to the website, but since this is in your slide, it's fairly easy. So you can see this is for staphylococcal nuclease. This is the other protein I was telling you about that's involved in germ warfare. And so this one looks for foreign DNA sequences and cuts them up in staphylococcus. But again, it's a biophysical protein, so nobody actually studies that functionality. They study folding and you know how many charged residues they introduce to the center of it. So it's an interesting protein, but it's used for its biophysical properties. But here, if you look at this, you know the percentile ranks are much, much worse, right? At best, this RSRC outlier is in the middle. I guess there's no Ramachandran outliers, so that's good. But there are some steric clash, and there are some side chains that are outlying. And so you can go through that. And again, if you look at when this structure was actually solved, you know, this structure, I think, was solved in the early 90s. And so again, it was before a lot of these sort of more popular validation methods came into play. But you know, the resolution isn't bad, the R value is reasonable. This was done again before R-free was popular or required. But still, the authors submitted their original structure factors, and so you can go look. And in principle, you could recalculate an R-free for it. But again, that would take some work, and you'd have to know the scripts to do that and use some different software. So anyway, so there's just a different example of a protein from a different era. It's not like if you go look at this structure, it's going to look horrible. It's just that it's going to have some factors that might not make it as good as some other structures in the PDB. Okay, so what does a PDB file look like? Because essentially we're going to be using PIMOL to visualize these molecules. And you know, that's essentially going to be the main goal of this. So from the PDB, you can go hit download files, and you can download the sequence if you want. But generally, if you're at the PDB, the reason you're at the PDB is because you want to download the PDB file. And so the PDB file is the file that actually contains the structure, the molecular coordinates. And so we're going to basically hit download file, and you want to get the PDB text file. The gzip is a compressed file, and you may or may not have the software to decompress it on your computer. So if you just get the text file, that's fine. And we're going to save that to my desktop, because why not? Okay, and close some of this other stuff. Now, where did you go? There we go. Okay, so there's our PDB file, just to prove that I have it. And let's take a look at some of the guts of the PDB file. So I'm going to open this up with WordPad. Okay, and so when I open it up with WordPad, you can see that it's well, no, you can't see because it's the wrong window. There we go. You can see that it's essentially just a text file. And now, why didn't I use Notepad? Well, it turns out that, so we didn't talk about this yesterday with Unix, but it turns out that Unix and Windows sometimes get confused about what constitutes the end of a line. And so it's always safest to use WordPad when you're editing a PDB file. And unfortunately, that often means you need to make the lines longer than they actually are. There we go. Okay, so this is your PDB file. Oh, look, it has anisotropic B factors. Okay, so lots of good stuff in here. So it starts out with a title. And so the basic format of a PDB file is going to be, I have my first six characters, and they're going to describe, you know, what that line contains. And so anything that contains COMPND, you know, is a description about the compound that is, you know, in that file. And so, you know, here's some stuff about, you know, is it genetically engineered? What's the name of the compound? Has it been mutated? What organism? So you can look at source. So what organism did it come from? There's all sorts of useful stuff in here. In many cases, this useful stuff is reproduced on the web page itself. Okay, and so for a human, oftentimes you want to look at the website. You know, don't waste your time trying to look through this to find out who the authors are. You can do that. There is author data right here, but it's much easier to go to the website and just say, oh, who are the authors? And, you know, bam, it's right there. So on the other hand, if you're using an operating system like Unix, or even some versions of Windows and Mac can do this, if you have the right, if you're using the right software, you know, all this information, it's nice that it's here because then you can get at it with a simple text edit. You know, so I can write a little script, and you know, within 10 minutes, I could list every single author recorded in the PDB because it's all right here in a text file. And all I would have to do is look for all of the lines that start with author and basically grab the list of authors from every PDB file. Okay, so it's extremely useful that this is a text format. But really what you guys want is you guys probably want the actual coordinates. Yeah, this one's sort of different. So let's switch to, we don't have to. So the coordinates are going to be stored in one of two record entries. Here it's called hetatom, so that stands for heteroatom. And you can see that there's like an atom record number, a residue number, the chain identifier, the atom name. So remember we talked about amino acids having, you know, C alpha or an N atom. Or in DNA, you can have like the C3 prime carbon. All of those have their own special name here in the PDB file. And so like this is N, this is C alpha, C beta, C gamma 1 and C gamma, or O gamma 2. I don't know what DTH is, but, and then over here you have your X, Y, and Z coordinates. Okay, and so that's where you would actually get your X, Y, Z. Remember that a PDB stores everything in angstroms. Okay, so, but let's switch, because this one has a lot of the heteroatom. It also has this aniso line, which are anisotropic B factors, and that's a little bit more detailed than I want to get into. So let's download 1SNC, because I know it's simple. Okay, and so just for your entertainment, I'm not even going to open this one in WordPad. I'm going to open it in Excel. Okay, so I told you these are text files. Excel does a reasonable job processing text files. And so, you know, what's the most useful thing? I mean, if you're not going to do any kind of specific programming, oftentimes you might want to know, you know, maybe you want to measure distances. The easiest way to measure distances in a PDB, Pymol is actually not that bad, but you can actually use Excel to do this. So let me show you how you would do that. So you could go here to Open, and Computer, it's on my desktop. There we go, Desktop. And let's see if I can find all files. 1SNC, Open. Okay, so it's going to do this text thing. And, you know, probably the easiest way to go is just to do delimited. So we'll hit next. And we'll use space, and we'll treat consecutive delimiters as one. Okay, and I think that's really all we need. Okay, so now if you look at this, I mean, some of this doesn't make sense, right? But some of it does make sense. Like, every single one of these first columns is basically my record entry. And so I just told you guys that atom records store the PDB coordinates, or the three-dimensional coordinates. So if I keep scrolling down here, eventually I'm going to get to
atoms. There you go. Okay, so I don't really care about all this. I'll delete it. And I can go down here to the very end of my atom list. Okay, so eventually here I start getting into the heteroatom. So this particular molecule has a substrate or an analog of a substrate. So, but this is where the chain ends, at the TER. So I'm going to delete everything after that. You can see there's also some waters, HOHs here, that are stored as heteroatoms. And then the end of the file just ends. Okay, but now I have basically a whole bunch of Excel file or Excel entries where column G is X, H is Y, and I is Z. And so any kind of tricks that you know with Excel where you calculate distances or, you know, X squared minus, you know, X1 minus X2 squared plus X or Y1 minus Y2 squared plus Z1 minus Z2 squared to calculate distance, for example. I mean, you can get at that information right here within Excel, and, you know, you don't have to worry about doing any kind of programming whatsoever. Just open it up as an Excel worksheet. And, you know, you could do other things, like if you only want to look at the C-alpha atoms, you can go up here and start using Excel and filter out. You know, so any tricks that you know with Excel, you can go here and start using them with your PDB file. Okay? Yeah? Yeah, so basically I go up here to File and I go to Open. And I just open the... Well, it's already here. Let's see if I can close it. Let's see. Okay. So basically I just open the PDB file and it automatically detects that it's a text file. And so now it's just a matter of giving the text import tool the right answers. And 9 times out of 10, you're going to use delimited. And then you're going to use space as a delimiter. But then always treat the consecutive delimiters as one. Otherwise, every time it sees a space, it's going to give you a new column. Okay, so this way, if it sees 4 spaces, it's going to give you a new column. If it sees 5 spaces, it's going to give you a new column. If it sees 50 spaces, it's going to give you a new column. Okay, and so once you have that, I mean, you can go through the rest of it and sort of confirm, but that's really all you need to do, and now you have it right there. Okay, so it's just a matter of opening the PDB file directly in Excel. It can be very, very useful if you're just trying to do something quick and dirty. Okay, so hopefully I've proved to you that PDB files, there's nothing mysterious about them, just a whole bunch of text that tells you different things. But, you know, Excel is not able to, you can't print graphics. Well, you can do graphics in Excel. You can't do 3-dimensional molecular graphics in Excel. So for that, what we're going to use is we're going to use a program called PyMOL. And so you all should have, and if you don't have it, it's up here. If I need to print out more copies, I can. But if you don't have a copy, then let me know. But this is the beginner's guide to using PyMOL. We're going to go over some of this stuff here in the session, but because we ran over a little bit with the last session, I might skip a little bit of this, but this does serve as a relatively good sort of introductory manual to PyMOL. But that said, there's sort of a, I don't know, sort of a battle going on for the purity of PyMOL right now. And I describe a little bit about this in the opening text of this tutorial, but PyMOL was originally written by a guy named Warren Delano. He was a fabulous scientist, and he wrote PyMOL while he was working in a crystallography lab at Yale. And, you know, he was good. He basically started his own company to do PyMOL, and, you know, seemed to be doing fine. But he committed suicide maybe about 5-6 years ago, more than that at this point. It was right as I was starting my postdoc. And so the question was, what's going to happen to Pymol? Because he was pretty much the main author on it. And after that, a company named Schrodinger picked it up, and Warren had written everything in open source. He was a big proponent of open source software, and so I knew him, not super well, but enough that I had met him several times. And so his model was basically, you can have the software for free, but if you want any kind of support or help or assistance, you know, you should buy a license. And so that was how he made money. But when he passed away, Schrodinger bought this, and Schrodinger is not like a nice progressive corporation. They're more of a, you know, we want to make as much money as we possibly can type of a corporation. And so, they've been slowly making it harder and harder to use Pymol for free as an academic. And so their most recent, you know, now what they say is, even if you're an academic, you're supposed to buy Pymol. And so I don't do that. And then they have an educational version that's free. And for the longest time, the educational version that was free was perfectly acceptable. I mean, it was usable. It had all the same, maybe not every single feature that the latest versions had that you could buy, but it was perfectly usable. The most recent educational version, I was playing with it last week, though, they disabled ray tracing, and there were bugs with it, like you would click on some of the windows and everything would start flashing like crazy. And so if you go and you register for educational Pymol, you're going to have problems. And so my recommendation is to use the older version. Right now you can still get that if you register for educational Pymol. They go to the website and they have the older version listed there. And that version is the 1.3R1. Alternatively, and maybe Schrodinger will feel my ire and start contacting me and tell me to take this down, but for now, you can download Windows, Mac, and Linux versions at these links, and that's off of my server. And so they might not like it, but I don't like them. So, up until recently, I was kind of neutral about Schrodinger, but I sort of think that they've crossed the line now by crippling the software. The other thing is, because it was open source, and this is why it's frustrating to me, it is open source, and so you could download it and compile it yourself, in which case you would be able to run an uncrippled version. But they're taking advantage of the fact that most academics don't have the time or the expertise to compile their own software. And so one alternative that's still useful in what we do upstairs is we basically use the compiled version that Debian maintains. And so we use Linux. Linux maintains their own compiled version of Pymol. And so technically I don't have to worry about violating any licenses because we're using a user compiled version, just not the one that Schrodinger provides. So that's sort of the introduction to where all this comes from. The long story short, just use these links and you'll get something that works and that works well. It will say educational use only when you use it up at the top of your window. But then if you ray trace or try to make a graphic for a journal article or a poster, that educational use only will go away. And that's probably why Schrodinger got rid of ray tracing, because they knew you could get around it. But regardless, whatever. Okay, so let's take a look at Pymol. So you can see that, you know, normally if you just downloaded a PDB file right here, you would probably not see these little molecular images. But since I have Pymol installed, that's the little image it gives you for a PDB file. And if you double click on it, you're going to get a window that looks something like this. Okay, well, actually, on a Mac, you'll just get one window. And so the Mac version, I think, is actually a little more polished. Warren was a big fan of Mac software, so I think he did that on purpose. The PC version, you just have the two windows, and the Linux version is the same way. But essentially, you have this This upper window where you have your standard menu options, you can do a lot from here. So you can, you know, change your display options. If I want to make this a black or a white background for a poster, for example. Now it's harder to see, but generally when you're printing something, you're going to be printing it with a white background. And then the lower window is where you would actually see the molecule itself. And so I opened up staphylococcal nuclease. So this is what staphylococcal nuclease is. And basically what PIMOL is doing is, you know, it's taking the three-dimensional coordinates stored in the PDB file, and it's using your computer graphics or your computer's processor to basically show you what those coordinates look like in a pseudo three-dimensional space. Okay, now, a lot of you guys, you know, does anybody have a three-dimensional TV, 3D TV? Yeah, I guess you guys are all graduate students. Okay, well, with the advent of 3D TVs, I mean, PIMOL can actually, and 3D computer monitors, PIMOL can actually plot this in three dimensions, so that you, if you're wearing the glasses, you can look at it in 3D. That technology has actually been around since the mid-80s. And so don't think that that's new. It's actually quite old. It's just that it was in the consumer space, and then I think now it's not really popular anymore because nobody wants to wear glasses when they watch TV. Or more glasses. I guess some of us have to wear glasses all the time. But anyway, so you can see here, I mean, these are the three-dimensional coordinates of light, of staphylococcal nuclease. For those of you that know your protein structure, let's make this a little bit bigger. Now, does it make, you know, that might be the limit. My graphics card can't support me bigger than that. That's what you get for having a laptop. Anyway, so you can see, actually, I mean, if you look here, if you know your protein structures really well, you can see things like lysine sticking out here. You know, if you move things around, you can start to see, like, here's a phenylalanine. But in some sense, this is really hard to visualize. Additionally, you have all these little plus signs. Now, I can click on those, and it'll tell me what they are. So if I, now, you guys in the back here. Okay. So here you can see what I clicked on. You said you clicked 1SNC/A. So that means the molecule is 1SNC. The chain is A. And you clicked HOH number 230. And I clicked the oxygen of that HOH. So I basically clicked on a water molecule. And so this little guy and all these other little plus signs, you can see if I click them, they're all little water molecules. And so remember, I told you that you could put water molecules in here. Now, some of these I believe more than others. You know, there's one in here that's sort of ridiculous. There it was. Yeah, this guy. Like, I sort of doubt that that's actually interacting with anything in the protein. And a lot of times when you're working with a molecule like this, you don't really care about the waters, you care about the protein. And so to give you a feel for what you can do here, if I go over here, this is my list of open molecules. So if I click on this 1SNC, I can make it disappear. But it has an action window. And so if I click the little A, and now there's all sorts of actions that I can do on this molecule. So, and one of those is remove waters. So if I click remove waters, all the water molecules are gone. Okay? And there's other things here. So I can think of, you know, if I click the S, that gives me show. And so now I have different types of ways that I can display this molecule. So if I click sticks, you can see now it's showing it as sticks. If I click spheres, you can see it's displayed as space-filling spheres. So these are the covalent radii. And so you can see, even though, you know, on a visualization technique, like if I just look at, if I hide spheres, so that's the H. So you might look at the lines and you say, well, there's lots of empty space in there. But if you actually look at the spheres, it's like, no, there's not empty space. Okay, so and then you also have label and color. And so you can, you know, color things by element. You know, maybe you want to make your carbons gray or whatever this blue color is. You can color everything uniformly. So, you know, there are options to do things here, but really the most useful tool, and what you guys are probably going to be using if you use PyMOL most frequently, is the command line interface. So this has a command line interface just like Unix does. And in particular, if I go down here and click into this little PyMOL box, you can see I can type commands like, you know, hide spheres. Util cbay. So there are commands that allow you to change the graphical state of PyMOL, and it also has a reasonable help system. So if I hit escape, my graphics window goes away and I'm left with sort of like a help screen. So if I type, you know, help show, it gives me a listing of all the things I can do for showing. I can select specific atoms. So I can do like show spheres, comma, het atom. So oftentimes heteroatoms are atoms that are included in your PDB but aren't really part of your protein. So if I type show spheres, het atom, and then I go back into my visual mode, you can see I can look at that substrate analog. So it's THP, and then that's a calcium ion right there in green. So and your tutorial, so again, this is sort of just to give you the very basic idea of how to do this. Your tutorial covers a lot of the selection commands and some of the most frequently used command lines that you would use. But, you know, it's always good to be able to see how they work and what you have to do. And then the final thing that I think I'm going to show you before we wrap up here is what Schrodinger disabled in the newest version. So you can see this is still the educational use only version. But if I go here and I ray trace, or I type ray, what's it going to, it's, well, you can't. So easy to tell the difference. That looks a little better. Let's go here to setting, quality, maximum quality. And now again, if you're doing a publication, they want you to do CMYK colors. You can select that here. Let's put it in. Let's show the cartoon representation. Let's hide the sticks and the lines. Okay, so there we have the cartoon representation of the helices and strands. And let's ray trace this. So you can see it does a little bit nicer job with the shadows. And this is what you would want to include in a poster or a journal article. Now, oftentimes, posters and journals, they want extremely high resolution. And so if I go, if it doesn't say, but if I want higher resolution, like I want 2,000 pixels wide, I can do ray 2,000. And then when it's going to take longer because it has to do more calculations. But now it gives you the image size. So this is 2,000 by 1260. If your journal says, I want 300 pixels per inch, well, now you have the number of pixels. You can divide that by the number of, you know, if you do 300 pixels per inch, how many inches is that going to be? So that's going to be pretty big. But, you know, suppose you're going for the cover image and you want a nice, really big molecular graphic. This is how you would get that. And then to save it, you can go up here and file and then say, you don't ever want to touch your mouse. Because then it goes back to the non-ray traced interactive version. But to save it, you can go here in File, and then they have Save Image PNG. So you can save it as a PNG file. If you want to save your sessions, so you want to save how you, you know, the fact that this is yellow, there's cartoons, you can save your session too, and then you can just send your session file around, and that continue. You don't have to keep the PDB with it. The PDB is still stored in the session file. And that way you don't have to go back and type, you know, ray trace this, or, you know, show this as spheres, show this as lines. All that stuff is stored in the session. And so that's a useful tool to have if you're trying to, if you're passing something back and forth with your advisor and they say, no, I want to see this in blue. You know, you don't have to, if you just have the session file, it's saved, you don't have to go back and remake your whole image. But there's a lot of useful things, many of which are covered in the tutorial, many of which are covered online in the help system. And so we're not going to cover it all, but it is a very useful piece of software. Okay, so I think we did have a summary page here. PDBs are complex models. We had this thing, it comes up in your tutorial as well, seeing is deceiving. You can very easily tweak a PDB file to make it say something that it really doesn't. And people have done that. So remember that PDB files are models, and like any model, they have weaknesses and strengths. Very easy to access atom properties and names. And HiMole is a useful software that can make nice, pretty pictures. But as you work through your tutorial, you'll be able to see how you can also do things like measure distances and select things within a particular distance to draw, like the atoms that interact with a particular drug molecule or something like that. Okay, questions?